The Kenites are involved here as well. They may have been a division within the Midianite structure in Judges 4:11. Hobab, son of Moses, Midianite, father-in-law and brother-in-law of Moses, is called a Kenite. So his descendants are both Midianites and Kenites. The nature of the relationship is uncertain. I just told you everything that I know about it, and I think everything that we're going to know about it, that it's just not clear, and it doesn't need to be clear. The Midianites seem to have been nomadic. They were moving usually with the seasons of the year. When Israel entered the Promised Land, the Midianites were using donkeys for transportation, but in Gideon's day, they had a lot of camels. Now, Abraham had camels when he arrived in Canaan. Job had thousands of camels wherever it was that he lived. We know it was the land of Uz, but we don't know where that was. At least I don't. But William Albright, the archaeologist, said that this oppression by the Midianites against the Israelites during the time of the Judges was the first known instance of full-scale use of camels in warfare. And that very well may be true. With camels, they were able to make wide-ranging raids in arid areas. The Moabites, Ammonites, and Midianites were all crowded into a relatively small, semi-arid region south of the Jabbok River and east of the Dead Sea. I think you got maps in your Bibles if you need them, but just a small area, and you had these three nations there. It wasn't large enough for all three of them to be strong at the same time. Therefore, when any one of them was strong, the Moabites, the Ammonites, or the Midianites, when any one of them was strong, the other two of them, by definition, had to be relatively weak because they're all crammed into the same area. One of them dominated about all the time, and it wasn't always the same one. Number five would be the Ammonites. Ammon was a half-brother of Moab, descended from Lot. The Ammonites were semi-nomadic, but they did have some cities. Their capital was Rabbath-Ammon, presently the same city as the capital of Jordan, Amman, Jordan. Same city as Rabbath-Ammon in the Bible. The Jabbok River springs forth in the city of Amman, causing the city to be called the father of water, the city of water. I'm sorry, called the city of water. The Ammonites also controlled a portion of the king's highway, which was an international road which joined northern Canaan with southern Transjordania. This gave them political power and an economic boost through taxation of caravan travel. They could charge the caravan whatever they wanted, and Duke could say no. The only way you could say no was if you were strong enough to defeat them. And your little caravan wasn't going to defeat this whole nation, so they could charge whatever tolls they wanted. And they did charge some exorbitant tolls. The Ammonites had the Arabian Desert as a natural border on the east, but they lacked a natural border on their west, and so they established border fortresses there, and evidence of these fortresses still exist today. Long story short on the Ammonites, they were a hard and rugged people. They were fierce and brutish in their behavior. The Old Testament is peppered with their atrocities. These are the people that murdered Gedaliah later on. They ripped up pregnant women in Gilead. They were the enemies of Judas Maccabeus in the second century before Christ. And then they disappeared from history, just as Ezekiel had predicted that they would in the 25th chapter of the book of Ezekiel. Now we get to the Philistines, sixth and last. As I mentioned a moment ago, they didn't arrive in large numbers until the Judges era was partly over, probably about half over. And they came from the Aegean region as a part of the Sea Peoples. Some Philistines were already in Canaan, even as early as the book of Genesis, of course. Abraham and Isaac had some dealings with some of these folks. But they weren't numerous enough early to make serious trouble until the larger migration. No big problems of conflict are reported until the Philistine oppression in the book of Judges. Their coastal strip along the Mediterranean came to be known as Philistia, and the name Palestine came from that expression, Philistia, apparently. They had five principal cities. Gaza, Ascalon, and Ashdod were all located along the same road, the Via Maris heading north, whereas Gath and Ekron, the two other cities, were further inland. Each one of these cities had a chief ruler, and together they seemed to have ruled the land. The Philistines were a different kind of foe than the prior oppressors. They were new to this land. They had a background in fighting. They were intent on taking over. They were better organized than their prior foes. They had chariots. Now, Sisera had chariots, but the Philistines had iron weapons. They held a monopoly on the smelting of iron. No smith was found in Israel. If you read this material, that probably stuck in your mind. The Philistines did not allow the Israelites to make swords and spears. When an Israelite wanted his plow or his sickle or his axe sharpened, he had to go to Philistia to have it done. Israel's weapons and tools would still have been made out of bronze at this point. But the Philistines had iron weapons, and an iron sword could cut a bronze sword right in two. So that was a substantial advantage. The Philistines brought the final oppression of Israel and the worst one. So we had a prepared people who entered a prepared land with high hopes. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. That's Judges chapter 2, verse 7. And then in verse 11, four verses later, we read that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam. And that is key. From there on, the book of Judges presents a marked contrast with the book of Joshua, and the reason was sin. The theme of the book of Judges is Israel's defection from God. The chief deity of the Canaanites was this Baal, the weather god, god of storm and rain. Asherah was a female deity, the consort of Baal. Asheroth was a goddess of fertility, also linked with Baal. There was another goddess by the name of Anna, who may have been the queen of heaven that's referred to in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 44. Clear distinctions between these goddesses, Asheroth and Asherah and Anna. Clear distinctions were not always observed. You read one story and it'll be one of them, and you read a very similar sounding story and it's another one. I think they were fluid in their public concept. But what we do know is that worship of these goddesses involved sacred prostitution. Their mythology includes stories of extreme brutality and gross immorality. The Canaanites believed that the farmer was completely at the mercy of Baal. And you can imagine, if you were an Israelite farmer in this country, you're there in the first generation, and you have a poor harvest. You don't know if you're going to have enough food to eat or not. Or even if you have a harvest that's not quite as good as your Canaanite neighbor, because unfortunately you didn't get rid of those people like you were supposed to, so now you're living side by side in many cases. This was an incentive to worship Baal. You see your Canaanite neighbor, and as he farms, and maybe when he gets to the end of the row, he stops at his little shrine and worships Baal, and maybe he had a better crop than you did, and so you start to get interested in Baal. What's this about? What can Baal do for me? And they began to follow the Canaanite system of worship. That was the principal sin of Israel in this period of time. Even sacred prostitution eventually came to be accepted in Israel. But there were other sins as well. And as I said, I think the purpose of the last five chapters of Judges seems to be to represent the sins of the time. Probably the sins mentioned in them were general sins of the day among the people generally. Now, there were righteous people. I think that's the reason we have the book of Ruth, in part. It was given partly to make that point. But these stories at the end of Judges did not appear chronologically. I want to stress that. They occurred rather early within the period when sin had not become as extensive and serious as it did later. Maybe we ought to talk about those stories just for a minute. In Judges chapter 17 and 18, let's think about that. I'm going to assume you've read these stories and are fairly familiar with them. But Judges 17 and 18 is about Micah and the Danite movement. The Danites moved shortly after their original land had been allotted. This movement is also mentioned in the book of Joshua, in Joshua 19:47. And we know that the book of Joshua was written while Rahab was still alive. Chapter 6:25 makes that clear. And I'm assuming that the book of Joshua was of one piece and was written at the same time. But if the book of Joshua was written at the time during Rahab's lifetime, then it's relatively early. This is that same time. So Judges 17 and 18 happens relatively early. Does that make sense? Okay. In the area of Mount Ephraim, Micah had stolen some money from his mother, and then he paid it back. And she used part of this money to establish a private sanctuary for Micah, a religious sanctuary, where he could worship God in what apparently both Micah and his mother thought was a proper way. Micah made his own son a priest in this place of worship, and later he hired a Levite who happened to pass by. There was a committee of five Danites that came looking for new quarters for their tribe. They visited the sanctuary. They were impressed by what they saw. And after they found new land to move to at Laish, they went back to Dan and gave their report. 600 men from Dan with their families moved to conquer this northern area. They also passed by Micah's private sanctuary. They stole everything that they could from him and lured away the young priest, probably by persuading him that they could do more for him than Micah could. Micah caught up with them and protested, but he was unheeded and without recourse. So Micah returned home empty-handed to try to reconcile himself to the injustice and what had happened to him. Long story short, there's at least six areas of sin represented here. Number one, the Danites moved from a place that God had assigned them. That was wrong. Number two, the establishment of a private sanctuary for religious purposes was wrong. God's sanctuary with the tabernacle was supposed to serve as the main unifying factor among the tribes. The tabernacle was where all the pictures of New Testament truth were, and the people were supposed to indoctrinate themselves in these truths to the extent of the knowledge available in their time. So making this private sanctuary was wrong. The making of images was wrong. That was the third thing. We have found lots of Canaanite images. We have never found any representation of Jehovah that we know of. Now, it may be that the representations of Jehovah just weren't different enough from the Canaanite gods so that we can tell when we find a little figurine who it's supposed to be. That could be the reason we don't find it. But we've never found one that was marked Jehovah or that appeared to, that somebody was trying to represent Jehovah. However, Micah clearly intended to worship Jehovah with these images, so he may have had what he deemed to be images of Jehovah. Anyway, the making of images, no matter who they were of, and using them for worship. Also, improper priesthood. Micah first appointed his own son, and then he hired an available Levite, and then the Danites appropriated the Levite. It's really weird stuff. Number five was the movement of a Levite. We've already talked about that. He was an opportunist, looking for someplace better, coming from Bethlehem, which wasn't even a Levitical city itself. And the sixth thing, area of sin, is stealing. Micah stole from his mother. The Danites stole from Micah. So we've got at least these six areas of sin in the story. Now, in the second story at the end of the book of Judges, Judges chapter 19 through 21, this one also is early because Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, is still high priest at the time. That's shown in chapter 20, verse 28. So this is very early. Remember, Eleazar comes into the promised land, and when he dies, Phinehas, his son, becomes the high priest. How long does the man live? We're just barely, I don't have the timeline up here, but we're just barely into the period of the Judges at this time. So Judges 19 through 21 has to be early because Phinehas is still living. Let me tell you the story just as briefly as I can in case you don't know it. A Levite and his concubine stopped at Gibeah just north of Jerusalem to spend the night. During the evening, the men of the city insisted that the Levite's host bring out the Levite so that they might know him in the Sodomic sense, shades of Sodom here. The host refused to bring out the Levite so that they could have sexual intercourse with him, but he offered them his own daughter and the Levite's concubine. And so that's what happened. The concubine was so abused by being violated all night that she was only able to get back to the doorstep of the house before she died. The Levite, I guess, was just in the house all night, theoretically sleeping soundly. I don't know. It reminds me of that old song, "I would have gone out after you, but I didn't feel like it, let my head get blown off." That was, you know, I like to see some gallantry in a man. When the Levite finally found her in the morning, he took her body home, cut it up into 12 pieces, and sent a piece of his concubine to each tribe. As many as 400,000 men came to Mizpah and insisted that the tribe of Benjamin turn over the guilty parties to them. This is, incidentally, the only instance in all the book of Judges where all the tribes joined together in a concerted effort in this story, all but Benjamin, of course. But the rest of them are all together. This was still early in the period when they had a semblance of being able to work together. Later occasions of united effort are found with only a few tribes joining into any venture. Well, Benjamin refused to turn these men over to this army, and war ensued. The Benjamites amazingly won the first two battles, but in the third battle, the forces of Benjamin were devastated. All but 600 of their men were killed. So from a tribe, they've come down to just 600 men left. The congregated tribes against Benjamin also slaughtered all the women and children of Benjamin. So now you had 600 men comprising an entire tribe, and those 600 men had no tribes, had no wives, and the tribe of Benjamin was facing extinction. So the 600 men of Benjamin were allowed to steal daughters from Jabesh Gilead and from Shiloh until they had total of 600 wives. At least four areas of sin in this story. Number one is sexual sin, the active seeking of homosexual contact, and also the sexual abuse of the concubine. Two, defense of the guilty. the seeming indifference of the whole tribe of Benjamin to this outrage. It seems like they really didn't think this was a big deal. And maybe that was because it happened fairly frequently, this type of thing. Number three goes with that, a low respect for human life. This seems to have been taken as a matter of course, that you would just go in and the slaughter of the Benjamite women and children was absolutely unnecessary. They hadn't been involved in this. The same with the slaughter of the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead. That was unnecessary. And the fourth sin is the violation of personal rights. It seems that there was a complete disregard of the concubine as a human being. She was just taken and used by these men until she couldn't even sustain physical life. And the personal rights of the 600 women who were stolen away seem to have been not considered at all. So those are four areas of sin in this story. Interestingly, in these two stories, Judges 17, 18 being the first story, Judges 19 through 21 being the second story, in these two stories, neither story says anything about Baal worship, which was the primary sin of the period, and it's not even mentioned in these two stories. Apparently, chapter 17 through 19, these two stories we're talking about, were given to illustrate other major sins of the day. Because every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And I can convince myself that anything's right if I want to, and so can you as a human being. Each of these stories stresses a particular area of sin. The first story emphasizes sins with regard to religion, and the second story emphasizes sins with regard to social relationships. The first story, we have the private sanctuary, the improper priests and Levites, and the images. In the second story, we have the abuse of sex and brutality. So these two main areas of sin, religious sins and sanctuarial type sins and sexual type sins, were directly related to the Canaanite influence of Baal worship, so that even though Baal worship specifically is not mentioned here, the two stories show ways in which the primary sin of Baal worship affected Israelite life at the practical level where you live. Because don't forget, everything always goes back to religion. Well, maybe that's enough of a 5,000-foot view. I was asked to give a brief summation of each judge, and I want to try to do that. I mentioned that there were six minor judges, the longest record of which is only three verses. The first major judge has a record of only four verses in chapter 3, verses 8 through 11. Remember, Tom, go ahead.
I was just going to ask
that
phrase, those who are every man who is the
Well, it's favorable in that God was allowing people freedom. Personally, I love freedom. I think most of us do. All God's creatures love freedom. This is why when you go out in the yard, not this time of year so much, but in the springtime in May when the rabbits have just been born, maybe you pick up a rabbit's nest even right in your yard. You pick up a little rabbit and it struggles to be free, even if you're being nice to it. It just doesn't want to be with it. It wants to go be what God made it to be. It wants to be free. All God's children love freedom. And God had given them almost 100% absolute total freedom. He gave them only those restrictions that they needed to function as a society. So yes, there's good in it from that point of view. The problem is the sin. The sin springing, we could say, from the nature of man, from the will of man, man wanting to go his own way. Not thy will, but mine be done. So yeah, ideally it's perfect. Ideally it's perfect. No taxes. But realistically, man has never handled that very well. Good question. Did you have another thought about that?
I always thought of it. I always thought of it.
Well, if the people were going to live as they did, they needed a king. It's too bad. I mean, it's really sad. And that, I think that's what God is acknowledging in 1 Samuel 8. That yes, if they're going to persist in degenerating further and further, then they do need a king on them. And it was too bad. Everybody with any sense was sad about it. But God allowed it because of the reality of the situation. And there are huge lessons here for us, obviously, with regard to the church and with regard to our own personal. Any other questions or thoughts there? Okay. These judges remember, were not routine appointees who inherited their jobs from the previous generation, as kings often tended to do. They were especially selected by God in an emergency. They were not just ordinary people, flawed though they sometimes were. They had to be qualified. They had to be able to inspire. They had to be able to lead. They had to be able to plan military strategy in many cases. They had to be able to overcome obstacles, no matter what those obstacles were. They had to have good judgment. They had to be capable of counseling. They had to be able to show wisdom. They had to be, at least at some point in their life, spiritually right with God, because they were chosen by God for this work. Here's an interesting thought. Victory over an oppressing enemy was achieved every time one of these chosen people made the attempt. Every time. There never was any failure. That's a telling point. Not only that, but peace followed these victories as long as one of these people called judges continued to judge. Peace followed. God did not permit additional inroads of oppressors. God was with these people. At least four of the judges had the statement made of him that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Othniel, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson have that explicitly said of them, but it may have been true of all the judges. However, we should not conclude that all of the judges were of equal ability or of equal spirituality, because they certainly were not. A little bit about each one as we have time. Othniel was either the nephew or younger brother of Caleb. The phrase that's used in chapter 1, verse 13, and chapter 3, verse 9 could either mean that Kedez or Othniel was Caleb's younger brother, but I think it means that Othniel was Caleb's younger brother. The Masoretic scholars believe that, and they made a division. Their notations were called Masora. In their Masora, they made a division in the text between son of Kenaz and brother of Caleb, indicating that they thought that Othniel was Caleb's younger brother. I think so, too. Caleb is otherwise said, though, to have been the son of Zephuna. Othniel is here and elsewhere called the son of Kenaz, so I'm thinking that Othniel may have been a younger half-brother of Caleb, through the same mother but a different father. However that may be, Othniel defeated the giant Anakim who lived in the region of Debir. Caleb, remember, had been granted this area and had defeated the Anakim at Hebron. And then Caleb asked for a volunteer who would take the lead in doing the same thing at Debir, and Caleb promised his daughter, Aksa, as wife to the man who succeeded. It was Othniel who volunteered. This shows his courage. It was Othniel who succeeded. This perhaps shows his ability. And he was given Aksa. Marriage between an uncle and a niece was not forbidden in the law and was not particularly rare either at this time or in other times up to the Roman times. The Herods did this, and it wasn't thought strange by anyone. Aksa was his niece, but she easily could have been his age and probably was his age. Remember, Caleb had to have been at least 21 years old in Othniel. The reason we know that is that Caleb was 40 years old when he spied at Kadesh Barnea. And Othniel could not have been more than 19 years old at the time, because everybody who was 20 and above from the tribe of Judah, except Joshua and Caleb, died in the wilderness before entrance into Canaan. So Caleb was 85 at the time that Othniel defeated the Anakim. If Othniel was 21 years younger than Caleb, he'd have been 64 when he defeated the Anakim, and about 94 at the time of his judgeship. So he may have been considerably more than just 21 years younger than Caleb, but probably not more than 40 years younger than Caleb. Therefore, putting all that together, it seems that he was probably at least 75 when he became judge. The details of Othniel's deliverance of Israel from the Mesopotamians, or Hubiru, are not given in chapter 3, verse 10 of the book of Judges. We do know that fighting was a way of life for these people, the Hubiru, and beating them probably wasn't easy. 40 years elapsed before the second oppression. How many of those years Othniel continued in leadership after he beat the Mesopotamians is not told. Again, we have an accurate report, but we have a very selective report. One more thing about Othniel. He seems to have been a very humble man. His wife wanted him to ask her father for a field. And we find that Aksa herself ended up asking her father for the field. In fact, she asked not only for the field, but she asked for springs of water that went with the field. And Caleb seems happy to grant both requests to her. But my point is that Aksa, the wife, is the one who did the asking for the gift, not Othniel. Now, Othniel was the one who went out and won the victory when others held back. But Othniel did not presume upon his accomplishment. I like Othniel, and someday I hope to know more about him. But won't be happy in this world. Ehud was a Benjamite, and he used a few others of his tribe to assist him, but primarily he acted alone. For the Moabites to have crossed the Jordan into Jericho, they would have had to have taken over Reuben's territory to do that. Moab or Ammon may have held Reuben's territory a lot of the time. Remember those statements in Genesis 49 from the mouth of Jacob have a lot to do with what happens in the rest of the Old Testament. Reuben's unstable as water. He's not able to do too much that's worthwhile. And as a tribe, apparently that was also proved to a great degree. Whenever the important cities of the area, Heshbon or Medeba, are mentioned following this, they're always in control of Ammon or Moab. Reuben is seldom mentioned after this time and never in a way that shows that its own land was fully or even partially occupied. The Reubenites may have been pushed north into Gadite territory a lot of the time. Eglon possessed Jericho, a rather important city that's famous to us. It had lain desolate since it was taken in the days of Joshua when the walls fell down. Joshua had actually placed a curse on whoever would rebuild it, Joshua 6:26. Here's an interesting thing. The present site of the city of Jericho shows evidence of significant erosion. But both Garstang and Kathleen Kenyon, who were archaeologists who excavated at Jericho, spoke of the erosion that they encountered there, but there was only one place where this erosion did not occur, and that was on the hill above the spring. Elisha's spring was right below this hill. It was the water supply for the Old Testament city. Elisha's spring still flows today. On this hill, Garstang discovered the foundations of one lonely building dating to this time that we're talking about, in the time of Ehud. And there's a few pottery pieces there that were not duplicated in the tombs nearby. Both Garstang and Kathleen Kenyon dated these pieces to the time of Eglon's oppression, which is the last quarter of the 14th century, approximately. John Garstang believed that this foundation that they found was the foundation of Eglon's headquarters, and it very well may have been. There are at least a couple of factors in his favor on this. The city that is represented by this foundation was entirely too small to be the one from Joshua's day. Looks like it came from later on. And the pottery being different from that being the tombs nearby indicates that it may have been foreigners who lived there, because Eglon, when he had dead, he would have buried them back in Moab, not here on the wrong side of Jordan, as far as he's thinking. So, anyway, they probably have found the foundation of Eglon's headquarters, and I think that's just interesting to think about. Ehud was left-handed, which literally means hindered in his right hand. Eglon was in a summer parlor, literally an upper room of coolness. I'm not going to tell you the story of Ehud and Eglon. Most of you know that since you were a lot smaller than you are now. Ehud was courageous and capable and committed, and the Lord raised him up as a deliverer. Shamgar was third judge and the first minor judge, as I'm terming them. Probably he was toward the close of the 80-year peace period that followed after Ehud's deliverance from Moab. He's mentioned immediately after Ehud's story and immediately before the story of Deborah. Deborah even mentions Shamgar in her song in the fifth chapter, chapter 5, verse 6, which I think is an important thing. The record concerning him, as I've said, is only one verse long, chapter 3, verse 31. But there's no rationale for him to be mentioned at all unless it is to say that his name should be included among the list of judges. The words after him, that is, after Ehud, help us to this conclusion. After Ehud, the second judge, came Shamgar, the third. Seems to be, to me, at least implied in these words there. The fact that he was mentioned shows that he was too important to be omitted. His slaughter of 600 Philistines, as I say, may have been accomplished over a period of time. Go ahead. Jericho. Yes. All throughout the Old Testament, the city of palm trees and the city of Jericho. Maybe they showed more than buildings since nobody was rebuilding. Yeah, good thought. It might be. Good thought. Good thought. The ox goad was a more formidable method of killing people than a jawbone was. Samson killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. But Shamgar had an ox goad, which could be as long as 8 feet, could be as much as 6 inches in circumference at the thick end, and it would be sharpened at the other end and made of hard wood. These Philistines in Shamgar's time didn't have iron yet. At least I'm pretty sure that they did. That was introduced by the later Philistines. And so Of none of the other minor judges is it said that an enemy was defeated by him or that deliverance was effected for Israel by him, but Shamgar did both of those things. The Canaanites brought the third time of discipline. The story of Deborah takes two chapters. Chapter 4 is the report of the action, and chapter 5 is the song. But chapter 5 is important because it has information that helps us to fill out the story. Deborah's song is unique among the judges. It's very interesting. I love that about the stars and their courses. And they made war against Sisera. The poetic account contains no reference to Jabin, who was the king of Hazor. Very interesting. 80 years was the longest of any peace period in Judges, and suggests that the people had not as quickly fallen into sin after the Moabite oppression. There were also Egyptian military campaigns through southern Canaan at this time. They were directed primarily against the Hittites, but you did have Egyptian armies marching back and forth through, living off the land. That always leaves hardship behind, and that may be one reason that the Canaanites were kept from attacking Israel. God may have used that providentially to allow his people a period of peace. The Canaanites did not have a central kingdom. They had city-states, and Hazor was once again strong. We'll talk about the investigation of that. Jabin's general Sisera had his headquarters at the foot of Mount Carmel, probably because of the terrain. He had chariots, and it's a lot easier to use chariots when you're on level land than it is if you're in hill country. Chariots work far better when it's level. Deborah had already been serving as a judge, chapter 4, verse 4. She lived under the palm tree between Ramah and Bethel, which served as a landmark. She lived and served in Benjamin. She didn't go with Barak into the battle. After she assured the Lord, assured Barak that the Lord would deliver Sisera into his hand, she does not again appear in the story except to write and sing the victory song. She uses the word I three times in the victory song, in verse 3, 7, and 12. She is bidden to awake and utter a song, and that's why I think she wrote it. And it's really quite a fine piece of Hebrew poetry. Well, I've come to 1:15, and the first guy especially needs to stay on track with time or we'll get all messed up. It's been a pleasure to talk with you about this, and I'm sorry we didn't get through a coverage of each one of the judges. Maybe that was enough of a plate. 15-minute break? You'll be back in 15 minutes. Thank you.